All right, welcome to the work in progress presentation session. This is a lightning session, sort of like speed dating with research. Every presenter will have 5 minutes to convince you that they have the coolest new idea on the planet. My name is Jeff Kenning, I'll be chairing the session, and if anybody goes over their 5 minutes, I did have a really, really big hook that I was gonna use to pull them off the stage, but the TSA took it away from me. So I'm going to have to draw on my old football skills and actually physically tackle them. So without further ado, our first presentation will be from Andrew Wilson, and he's going to tell us all about FileBench.
Thank you, everybody. I'm Andrew Wilson from Sun Microsystems, and my colleague Piyush Shivam has recently joined the project also at Sun. I'm known around Sun as Mr. FileBench. I actually have a PhD. I could be Dr. FileBench, but I thought that was a little too highfalutin. So, spacebar. Whoops. Okay, so FileBench was started by an engineer named Richard McDougall at Sun about 5 or 6 years ago, and he was very heavily involved in performance measurement of file systems and became frustrated with all the different benchmarks he had to use, especially the micro benchmarks, and then conversely having to do things like TCP, gave him a lot of information, but was very time consuming to set up and run. And he wanted something sort of in between that was basically a model-based file benchmarking system where he could change the models easily and run a whole suites of benchmarks very quickly. And he developed the core ideas behind FileBench. They got heavily used at Sun, and after a while, and even some outside people, it was open sourced, but development lagged for a while. And about a year and a half ago, we decided that we really wanted to get it back as a mainstream file system benchmark, and started some serious work on it at Sun. So the basic idea of FileBench is that you write a model in a high-level language, which we call the F language, and run it through and test your file systems out with it, and then it collects a bunch of statistics and data for you. It's designed modularly so that it can be expanded. Various workloads are fed in. The high-level language statements, which we call flow ops, are configurable and can be added to at runtime, or new ones can be put in. The original plan was also to use that to have multiple clients. We started looking at doing that and decided that was a little bit too cumbersome to replace all the flow ops for each different client model we wanted. So there's been some new work to make it easier to plug in additional clients. And because of that, Piyush is actually working on an NFS version 3 plugin. And then we will be planning to go on to a SIFS plugin once that's done. And I've repackaged all of the basic POSIX stuff in a separate client of its own. Some of the key features of FileBench, on our distribution, we have quite a few predefined file workloads that we use internally at Sun. You can easily write your own or add more, and you can easily configure all these workloads by setting global variables within FileBench to modify the things. Most of the flow ops have attributes that you feed them that allow them to be modified. Some of the things we've added recently: random variables, which each time you access that, you get a random number drawn from a user-defined random distribution instead of just whatever constant number was there. It's always had the threads and processes. We've extended the file sets a bit. That was actually added a little later and originally just had files. We have unified files and file sets, so all flow ops that operate on files or file sets now operate on both and pretty much the same way, which makes it more flexible. Some example flow ops here: read, write, create, delete, semaphore, block, post, many, many, many more, quite a long list. And depending on the flow op, you may be able to do things like set the IO size, IO pattern, And now that you can do random variables, you can randomly have them change each time too, which there was limited amounts of that before, but we have a lot more of that now. Some of the newer features, we took advantage of the ability to add flow ops dynamically to do essentially inline subroutines called composite flow ops. That part wasn't so hard. The harder part was having local variables that you could pass in for each instantiation. And these then become global flow ops that any thread or process can execute. There have been a lot of requests for multi-client support. In the long run, we want to interface with a real multi-client framework, and there's a number of them out there. At the present time, they all they're going to require some work on FileBench to match the features properly. So in the meantime, we've put in a relatively rudimentary multi-client support using our FileBench, our Perl script that allows bench operations, and boy. Anyway, so we have multi-client support, video server workload, index file access, and I'm all out of time and about to get tackled. And you can come and talk to me at the poster session. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. My name is Hamza bin Sohail. I'm a grad student at Purdue University, and my WIP presentation would be about when more and more does not help sensible partitioning of cache. So there's a lot of work that has been done on buffer cache block replacement algorithms. And most of them generally expose the entire cache to applications, all the applications in a multiprocessor environment. So by that, I mean a cache block miss generated by application A can basically evict a cache block of application B. This basically can lead to cache hogging, which is sort of the overpopulation of one particular application in the shared buffer cache and adversely affect other well-behaved applications in the system. So to put in a nutshell, the philosophy followed is whoever wants more ends up getting more, which means that metrics such as cache access rate and instantaneous hit ratio are not monitored at runtime. So the thing is that then when we know that applications may or may not benefit when more and more cache is allocated to them, then why not basically reward the one who benefits more and give sufficient but not overly sufficient to the one who does not? So sort of enforcing a sort of maximum bound on such cache non-benefiting applications. So inspired by a 1960s Western classic, we named the hit ratio and the IO profiles such as good, bad, and ugly. And this is actually, these are the sort of profiles that are actually there. You can see the good ones, there's a hit ratio increases as cache size increases, which is good. IO requests are orthogonal to that. Bad, there's not much increase at all. And in ugly, you have a very small hit ratio, and the IO request is exceedingly large. So these are the sort of hit ratios and IO profiles you see. So what we did was to observe this cache hogging effect, we had the simulation environment. We used Akasim, which is a simulator that was developed by DSNL Purdue. It simulates the Linux 2.4 buffer cache, and we used an IO trace of GCC and Cscope running together to form a sort of a multiprocess environment for the simulator. And these traces were actually used in a paper by the same guys in Sigmetrix 05. GCC basically compiles the Linux kernel source code, and Cscope examines the Linux source code. It does sort of searches for keywords. And we basically disable the prefetching, which is a feature in the simulator. And in this graph, you can see the non-partitioned versus partitioned thing. Non-partition is the classical least recently used algorithm we all know about. And the partition thing is basically, you can see this GCC alpha and Cscope alpha. GCC alpha, these values are like the maximum fraction of cache GCC blocks can have. Same is the case with Cscope. And the other difference is that a GCC block would only be evicted by a GCC block, not a Cscope. The Cscope application that can't evict a GCC block. So we actually observe a 4% improvement in hit ratio by allocating 90% of cache blocks and 10% to Cscope. So even if you allocate just 10% to Cscope, you still actually end up getting better performance when the cache size is 4 MB, which was pretty interesting. And when you break it down and you observe the per application hit ratio, you see that you were able to, we were able to get a 20% increase in hit ratio for GCC when the cache size was 4, and absolutely no difference in case of hit, in hit ratio for C scope. And the global hit ratio was less, the improvement was less just because the number of C scope cache accesses were more than 10 times more than GCC accesses. Execution time we also observed, and we actually got improvement. You can see that when the cache size is 4 MB. And yeah, so the question is to eke out additional performance from caching and prefetching, can we dynamically partition the cache based on hit ratio and cache access rate of an application? These magic values which we came up, those were just static values. We just plugged them in. So the question is, can you come up with these magic partitioning values? What are the overheads associated with it? Certainly it's going to come at a cost. So if implemented in a real system, what's going to be the cost? And this is just sort of an explanation of how you can come up with that. The idea is monitor the instantaneous hit ratio and see how much improvement do you get when you allocate a bunch of blocks to a process. If it's if shows improvement, it's a cache benefiting application. Things to do, lots of things to do. It's just we've just started working on it, so lots of things to do.
My name is Vijay, and I'm going to be telling you about our solution to the TCP incast throughput collapse problem in cluster storage systems. Some of you may remember our talk on incast from last year's FAST, so I'm going to give you a brief introduction to what this is. So TCP incast can occur when performing synchronized reads in an Ethernet-based environment. So this graph here shows what happens when a client issues requests for data blocks striped over several servers in a real cluster environment. And as we show here, as you increase the stripe width, or the number of servers across which the data block is striped over, you see a order of magnitude collapse in throughput. This was first documented by David Nagel and others at Panasis a few years back, and they attributed the cause of incast to TCP timeouts. Now, they also provided application level solutions to try to avoid TCP timeouts. So why are TCP timeouts bad? Well, they impose a 200 millisecond delay between the transfer of subsequent data blocks because of the synchronized reads behavior. And it's 200 milliseconds because this is the default lower bound on when packets are retransmitted following a timeout in most modern kernels. So we wanted to try to find a promising solution last year at FAST from the networking perspective to avoid kind of giving this problem up to the application. One of the promising solutions we did find was just eliminating that 200 millisecond lower bound on retransmission periods. But we did this in simulation, and there were kind of questions of whether this was safe for the wide area use, effective, whether it would actually solve the problem in real world clusters, and whether it was practical, could we actually do it? I'll be addressing the issues of practicality and effectiveness next. So it turns out if you just want to completely eliminate the minimum retransmission bound, all you have to do is change, make a one-line server-only change in one of the TCP headers to basically drop timeouts by a large value. Unfortunately, you only get 5 millisecond timeouts. And this is because this is the limitation on when on how the default TCP timers track the passage of time in milliseconds and not microseconds, which is what you would see in a cluster environment. But doing so actually does improve things significantly. For small stripe widths, you actually see throughput improve almost to the optimal value of here 1 gigabit per second links. But it eventually kind of falls off after when you stripe your data across enough servers. So we wanted to see, can we get these microsecond level timers for TCP? It turns out the Linux kernel developers over the past year or so have been working on a high-resolution timer implementation that provides event timing in microseconds. So we modified the TCP Linux stack to incorporate these high-resolution timers, and we were able to achieve full throughput for as many as 47 servers in this particular real-world cluster. I should mention that this is just a limitation of the number of servers we could get on one switch. So hopefully I've convinced you that this is a practical and effective solution. But what about, you know, what's the need for microsecond level timers if the 5 millisecond one is good enough for today? So tomorrow's data centers might actually have 10 gigabit per second links with latencies in the tens of microseconds. So what we did in simulation was to artificially bound the retransmission duration to 200 microseconds, which is still in microseconds, but an order of magnitude higher than the latencies. And what we found was that performance eventually dropped when you striped your data across hundreds to maybe thousands of servers. If you eliminated the bound and allowed the timeouts to occur at the granularity of latencies in the network, we were able to achieve reasonable performance even out to when you stripe your data across 2,000 of servers. So we think this is a pretty good idea. And moreover, the important message is that TCP can work effectively if you allow it to respond to timeouts on the granularity of what latencies are in the network. And that's the emphasis I'm trying to make here. So to conclude, a single line, one server-only change can actually get you significant improvements to avoiding TCP incast problems for today's networks. But our microsecond timers, we hope, will be useful for the future. I also want to plug this CMU tech report that we've made available. It has some more in-depth studies recently about whether it's safe for the real world. And please feel free to talk to me at the poster session. Thank you.
This is Saba from University of Central Florida, and today I will briefly talk about our ongoing research. We are working with Hadoop, and this is a joint project with Grant and Dr. Wang at UCF. So in broader sense, the research problem is that we are looking at different scheduling policies for regular and speculative map tasks. Most of you who are working with Hadoop scheduler, they might be familiar that it schedules different tasks on the basis of data locality and also by the data contribution from each node. We have made certain observations based on different application behaviors that are like typical MapReduce applications. Normally, different blocks are assigned to a map task, and those blocks, they can that can be on multiple nodes. So what we are trying to do is we are trying to find different ways how we can improve scheduling policies for those specific cases. So our approach is, it sounds simple, that we are also considering I/O latency in addition to data locality for scheduling multiple blocks. We are also looking at different performance parameters, for example, how number of map tasks and DFS block size is related to I/O performance. And based on all these observations, we have identified three different cases. And these three different cases are on the basis of different ways you can combine different blocks that are assigned to a particular map task. The first particular case, okay, so we have kind of combined case one and two. Wow, what's wrong? Okay, so we have kind of combined cases one and two, where we combine different multiple blocks that are assigned to a map task. In first particular case, we are looking at independent data blocks. So if data blocks are independent, that means we don't need to transfer all the data blocks to one node where we are scheduling a particular map task. So for that particular case, we are kind of proposing to introduce transparent map tasks. So if you have one map task that has been assigned three blocks, and two blocks are on one node and one block is on another node, so you can actually schedule two different map tasks. In that case, you will have data transfer rate reduced to just zero. The second particular case is dependent data blocks. And in dependent data blocks, you cannot avoid data transfer. So for those particular cases, you need to find the node that has minimal I/O latency. And you can pick up that node and then use that node for data transfer. So for these two particular cases, we have looked at the performance improvement, like how much we can gain. So on one axis, we have number of chunks that are assigned to a map task. On the other side, we have number of chunks that need to be transferred, and we plot them against total transfer time. So the bottommost blue line where you can see the number of chunks transferred is zero is the best case, and the peaks you can see that are the worst case and that we are experiencing in the current scheduler. So the case three is like you have independent data blocks and you dynamically combine them. So in that particular case, you don't have any strict application requirement. So no one tells you what blocks to combine. So what we try to propose in this particular scenario is that if there are two blocks on one particular node, so you assign those two blocks to a map task. So everything is done dynamically based on the block localities and based on the minimum number of tasks that you need to schedule. So in this case, what we seek is that we try to reduce number of map tasks. So by reducing number of map tasks, we are kind of improving on the resources in terms of memory requirement. The red line is the current scheduler that will assign or that will always create the same number of map tasks. And the blue line is kind of the savings that we can gain by reducing the number of map tasks. So that's pretty much it for my presentation. If you have any questions, so feel free to stop by our poster in the poster section.
Good afternoon, my name is Roberto Pinheiro, and I'll be presenting or talking about a model for predictable and guaranteeable performance in buffer cache, specifically covering aspects such as latency throughput and firmness of the performance. Large distributed storage systems are often shared with a variety of applications. This application, on one hand, may have different type of performance needs, including throughput, latency, and responsiveness. On the other hand, they may tolerate different levels of performance degradation, ranging from hard real-time, hard guarantees, soft, and best effort. Some of these applications include multimedia, transaction processing, service level QoS, and real-time data capture, or including mission-critical backups and replication systems. Services. The idea is that our goal is to support the full spectrum of them and allow applications to make hard performance guarantees where they need it. Even though we implemented the ideas in the context of distributed storage systems, this can be applied in other areas. So far, we have schedulers that manage devices such as disk and network, and this particular research focuses on the aspect of the buffer cache management. As traditional approaches, we like to improve the performance, but not just that. We like to preserve the guarantees provided by these schedulers that are used to manage the devices, and also provide and extend new guarantees to the applications or services. At the core of our system, we enforce hard performance guarantees. In order to do this, it's necessary not just to make conservative assumptions, but also carefully design and coordinate each of the components. So to achieve predictability, we provide hard isolation at each of the components by means of the schedulers. Contrary to other approaches, we use device time utilizations as the metric used to guarantee access to the devices. How we do it? Well, basically we follow three steps. We enforce the buffer cache rates and periods for the IOs that are coming in and out of the cache. We partition the buffers and assign these buffers to the services and applications based on the performance reservation and characterization of the execution time of the device. We also carefully review all the buffer management policies to make sure that they preserve the guarantees and they don't conflict and interfere. Basically, we have implemented in Linux and comparing against plain vanilla on the left-hand side, and we see our solution on the right-hand side. And it works. It provides much better performance and, a stable performance, isolation, better isolation, and a slightly greater throughput, as we can see. If you have any questions or need any other details, you can feel free to ask during the poster session.
Good afternoon. My name is Philippe Daniel. I'm from France, as you can hear. And it looks like during the next 5 minutes, you'll have to deal with my weird accent and my non-predictable way of speaking English. So, okay. Well, the background to my presentation is using NFS in an HPC environment. In a good old time in a compute center, we had only a few machines, basically Create3 or Create3D or Create90. Then we had clusters. Bunches of smaller machines with dedicated interconnection networks to make them work together. In the future, we'll have kind of massive clusters, basically aggregation of clusters with thousands of nodes. We would like to use NFS in this environment. And we expect an exponential increase of the number of clients and the number of requests. And we came to the conclusion that no single NFS server will be able to handle such load. So the solution we choose was using a proxy. Proxy is a very common solution for reducing load. It's widely used for HTTP. And we got a product that can be used for NFS proxy server. As well, use of proxy will be make it possible to handle both data and metadata traffic. The product we use is NFS Ganesha, a Nomad product that we developed. It's an NFS server running in user space. Well, you can see the dedicated URL. It's a source4.std program. And it has a dedicated backend, and one of them make it possible to compile it as a proxy server. This will lead to this architecture. So we got this aggregation of clusters. Each of them is served by an NFS v4 proxy server dedicated to it. And the NFS v4 proxy server will access the main NFS server. This would perfectly fit in a perfect world where users do only access the data in a read-only way. But we all know that users will create new file system objects, they will delete it, they will write stuff to them, they will rename them, and they will do all the operations that will produce incoherency in between the various caches involved in the multiple NFS4 proxy server within the clusters, the massive clusters. So we have an issue there. And we first look for solution to the work that was done in multiple NFSv4 server accessing a cluster file system. Basically, there had been a tutorial on this 2 years ago at FAST 2007 on this subject. But cluster file system do have mechanism to ensure inter-client coherency. And multiple NFSv4 proxy server accessing a single NFS server cannot make such an assumption and rely on such mechanism. So we have another track to follow. And we decided that every proxy server involved in the massive cluster had to know what its browser proxy server is doing. So this is basically no insolvable solution issue. There is solution. And the solution is to have protocol for communication in between NFSv4 proxy server. The natural choice for choice protocol is NFSv4. NFSv4 is file-oriented. It's flexible. And most of them, it's already implemented in the server. So what we are currently doing in NFS Ganesha is implementing this interconnection communication protocol. And we use NFSv4, but we added a small additional operation. This operation will only be used in between proxy server, not a regular server, regular client will not see it. This OP proxy update operation will be used as the first operation in the compound request exchange in between proxy server. When a proxy server is making an operation that changes the state of the main NFS server, then it will issue an NFS compound request starting with OP proxy update to the other proxy servers so that to make them aware of what it did on the main NFS server. then the proxy server that receives such an operation will be able to get information from the compound request to know how to keep their cache coherent. The first implementation will only make the related cache entry dirty so that to renew them later, but it will generate traffic to the main NFS server. On a smarter implementation that will be done later, will be to reduce the operation contained in this specific NFS4 compound to replay things within the cache without accessing the main NFS server. This is currently our implementation, so this is a work in progress. And we expect first implementation to be done before the end of the year. Well, if you have any question, meet me by my poster.
Hello, my name is Esteban Molina Estolano, and I'm from UC Santa Cruz. I'll be telling you about our work and comparing the performance of parallel file system placement strategies. Parallel file systems use a number of different placement strategies to stripe files across the cluster. And we want to get a good understanding of the benefits and costs of these different placement strategies under different workloads. The challenge here is to sort of tease out the effects of just the placement strategies as opposed to comparing the entire file systems. And so in order to get some sort of performance results, we need to use a file system level details that aren't specific to a particular parallel file systems. And gaining a sort of understanding of parallel placement algorithms can benefit people who are creating parallel file systems as well as people who are using them. Our approach is to use a trace-driven simulator. Our simulator has a number of virtual clients that are being driven by traces from parallel workloads. And there's a placement simulator that can simulate several different placement strategies from existing parallel file systems. And the clients use that placement simulator to figure out where IO requests should be directed. And we've started with having a virtual cluster that's just counting requests, and that tells us information about workload bounds across the cluster. But that's not enough to actually give you performance numbers. Good bounds doesn't imply good performance. So we're in the process of refining the simulator so our virtual nodes are actually running on top of disk sim and on top of a virtual file system, and ultimately we're also gonna add a buffer cache and prefetching so we can actually get some performance numbers. Of course, to run these simulations, we need traces, and we have some traces already. We have some traces from Los Alamos National Labs, some synthetic checkpointing traces, and some real checkpointing traces, including a trace from an astronomy workload. And we have some traces from a commercial web hosting company. But we are still looking for more traces. We're interested in traces from other workloads, such as data mining workloads, large-scale scientific workloads, enterprise workloads, essentially different kinds of larger workloads that will exercise a parallel file system. Now, I'll briefly go over some of our preliminary results. This graph shows how balance varies over time for a particular workload that's a checkpointing workload. And one thing to take away from this plot is that with the Ceph placement strategy, you'll notice there are two lines for Ceph. One of them has redundancy turned off, and turning off the redundancy in Ceph, which is a replication, hardly affects the balance at all. Whereas in the case of Panassa's placement strategy for PanFS, turning off redundancy, which is rate 5, actually increases balance. Now with Ceph, one thing we can do to increase balance with this placement strategy is to reduce the chunk size. Ceph uses a chunk size of 4 megabytes by default, and if we drop it to 64K, which matches Panassa's and PBFS chunk sizes, we get considerably improved balance. Of course, balance does not imply performance, and by shrinking chunks down to 64K, we would expect to get a performance hit in the process. So our next step is, as I mentioned earlier, to refine the simulator to actually get performance numbers in addition to balance numbers. And if you have any questions, please feel free to find me at the poster session. Thank you.
Hello. My name is Christopher Mitchell. I'm from the University of Central Florida, and I'll be talking to you, everyone, about my project called Overlapped HPC Checkpointing with Hardware Assist. In the high-performance computing HPC world, as system size increases, we end up seeing a trend where more time is spent doing error recovery, and what that translates into is more time spent checkpointing. Now, to look at some research recently published from CMU, if these predictions hold true, by 2013, we're going to be spending 100% of our time writing checkpoints or recovering lost work. An unacceptable situation. So checkpoints are currently used to save application state so we don't have to start over from the beginning. And their I/O performance typically can be improved by either making the checkpoint files smaller, which is difficult because it's application dependent, or we can improve the write performance for the entire system. So currently applications are set up. Let's see if the pointer works here. Such that the application's running across several nodes, and when it's time to perform a checkpoint, everyone barrier syncs upon entry, and then synchronously writes out the content, and then goes ahead and barrier syncs again before resuming computation. This takes a lot of time. So what I'm proposing is we introduce an extra piece of hardware with non-volatile memory in it so that we can buffer the checkpoint write out. And instead of relying on disk performance, we can use a much faster piece of hardware to get the write accomplished faster, thus allowing the application without modification to exit the checkpoint stage faster, as seen in the diagram on screen. So this implementation calls for three key components: a fleet of storage servers with the buffer implemented. Currently, our experimentation is using mounted RAM disks on Linux, and they're mapped into PVFS2 so we can provide parallel I/O semantics. A daemon needs to be written together so that the data can then be transferred from the RAM disk to the network attached mass storage, the final destination for these files, automatically. And we need to add additional functionality to MPI I/O so that the redirection can take place so that data goes directly to the RAM disk that are being mounted instead of straight to their final destination. Current status as of last Sunday is we have the storage servers operational. Currently we're sitting on a 30 gig RAM disk for small scale testing. I have gone ahead and written a couple of extra scripts to save and restore the contents of the RAM disk in case we have a power outage or unexpected shutdown. I'm making them non-volatile. The servers are UPS protected. The daemon's been written and tested, and MPI I/O modifications are almost complete. At this point, we're just linking everything into mPitch. And we're planning on running small-scale tests on our in-house cluster, which is 16 nodes, and I'm currently working on setting up a larger scaled-out test with a couple hundred nodes using real-world applications to show that this has the potential to greatly improve performance. Preliminary testing that's been done thus far to prove the concept before moving into these larger scale tests has shown a 38% improvement in write bandwidth when comparing a 15 disk RAID 5 array to writing to the RAM disks, and 157% improvement when comparing the RAM disks to a 2 disk RAID 1 array, but note using much faster hard drives. These are numbers derived from direct write testing to the storage media, and we predict further improvements when the testing is rerun against the PVFS2 mapped media, because we'll be able to provide parallel I/O semantics. And I'll be more than happy to accept any questions during the poster session. Looking forward to talking to you then.
Good afternoon. My name is Surendra Chandra, and I'm going to talk about some work we are doing at Notre Dame. So the goal of our project is to develop a collaborative system, collaborative application for sharing contents. So in the illustration, we have four users, Bob, Alice, Tom, and Emily. And the project, the goal is they're working on certain documents that they want to modify together. Sort of think of like writing a paper for a conference kind of stuff. And to build the system, we need to first understand the kind of users and how they operate and stuff. And we notice that most users are wireless, at least in our campus. So we want to analyze the behavior of wireless users in a number of locations, including our own campus, and from IBM Research, which was published in Mobisys a few years back, Hotspot Federation from Montreal, and from SICOM. All of the traces were available from the CARDA database. So the short end of the story is the users were available for short durations, and the durations are getting shorter, right? So in terms of what they can do, there are sort of implications of what on the systems. So we went ahead and saw how these users would behave if they used traditional way of collaboration. So if they used a file locking server, central storage server, and they locked the contents before they operated on it, or they used some AFS-like last iterations model, or more of epidemic propagation systems. And the details, things don't really work. They don't work at the times when people are all online together. So if there's a whole bunch of users online, then locking systems means that, you know, you serializes the whole output. And in the case of the users, they tend to be diurnal. So essentially, systems do not work as expected when everybody is online. It works when nobody's online. So our takeaway message was these systems are not good at operating on a single content. So there are a lot of updates on a single content. These things don't really work. So our assumption for building our system was we should avoid having a single copy. So the way we do that is we create N versions. So there are a group of N users. We let each user have their own update version that they update. So in the illustration, we have, if I take one single document and I use different colors, the Alice's document is blue and Bob's document is orange. So each user has their own update document that they modify. That document is propagated epidemically to the others as a read-only copy. So each user could potentially have N different copies, one they get to modify and four that are read-only. So that changes the problem from operating on a shared copy to now merging all these copies into a single version. And that's what we call the moderated collaboration. So essentially, each user is responsible for incorporating the output from the other users into their own version, right? So it's similar to a manual reconciliation sort of CODA, FICUS kind of style, except you're incorporating the output from N different versions into their own copy. And you achieve eventual consistency, right? And to ensure that you know when the system is becoming consistent, we log all the operations that you do while operating on a version. So Bob can look at Alice's copy to see what versions of files did she open to make sure that. So if she opened a copy, the latest Bob's copy, while she was making her new modification, Bob can assume that she incorporated his changes into his version, and so on. So if you look at these traces, you can eventually get a sense of when the system is converging. Right? Again, we make an assumption that if you open the file, you understood and you incorporated those changes, but we are implementing this as a file system, so that's the information we have. So we implemented a prototype using JIT and FAS and Fuse, and we get acceptable performance. Essentially, this is a Fuse file system, and the transfer happens in the background, so the performance is not a big deal. That's all I have. So, and if you have any questions, feel free to talk to me at the poster session.
We have a minor technology change here.
This works?
Yeah.
Hi, my name is Avni Valdani, and I go to UC Santa Cruz, and this is some work that I did with, or I'm doing with Ethan Miller on probabilistic reputation for personal trust networks. So the problem that we're trying to solve is that out-of-band trust verification, which is useful and almost critical for some applications, is very hard and very expensive. Also, gauging the reliability and trustworthiness of a peer along many axes is difficult. Trust is a very overloaded term, and trust, you know, in one for one person can be a completely different set of things for trust for another person. I'll give this guy data, but I'm not going to give quite this guy the data in quite the same time he wants it or quite the same quality he wants it. And so you need to have a more rich a rich measure of what trust is. And we also wanted to create a lightweight information survival system. In essence, what we're trying to do is create a version of Freenet on a diet so that it's accessible and it's more reliable. And we're doing it in a completely different way. And so our approach is to calculate trust dynamically and use it to make locally optimal decisions per node. So a basic network model, all these colors are awful, is that we have a more trusted and a less trusted domain. We expect when we simulate this for the clusters to appear that represent companies or institutions or even individual groups of friends that are just K-connected groups of people who are more likely to have trust relationships to each other. Here, all the lines represent a trust relationship. It's completely independent of location or anything like that. The node in the center with the eye represents you. This is your outlook into the system. And everybody's outlook is separate and private. The circle around it is nodes that it trusts a little bit more. And so it'll treat those nodes slightly differently for seeding, as we'll see in a minute. And then outside is the rest of the world. We can bootstrap with a little bit of out-of-band trust if we have it, or we can randomly select a set of peers and go from there. And the network will grow as you successfully read data. Global trust is susceptible to an attacker waiting until trust is high before striking. If you know that the time is right, you can go ahead, whereas with the private trusts, the attacker only knows what they see into the system, and the damage is thus limited when he does attack. And also, the node is compromised, the attacker only gains a little bit of information. All right, data management. So to read data, you have your inner set of trusted peers, and you ask them for a map file, similar to BitTorrent, you have maps and torrent files. And requests of maps and data are passed through chains of peers, and then reputation is updated based on a successful read. For writing, the nodes are sends out a number of replicas proportional to the trust it sees in the system. Again, this is different for every node, and so some nodes might see the area around them is looking pretty good, and so they feel like if they put information out, it's not likely to be taken away by an adversary. Whereas some nodes might see it looking awful. Even if you send it out to a node and you think it looks pretty good, that node is free to say, oh, the network doesn't look pretty good. I'm going to reseed this information to make sure it gets across. And then a node, yeah, the node receiving a replica can send it forward. So the current status of this project is that we can simulate faults and automatically detect select fault classes and then update the trustworthiness accordingly. And so we're doing that in SymPy and just going to getting in more of an overall simulation. And then we're simulating the P2P aspect on Planet Lab. And if you have any questions and comments, I'll be at the closer session.
Good afternoon, everyone. I am Mansi, and I'm here to talk about some work that's currently underway at IBM Research. We are trying to find an optimal storage solution for extremely data-intensive applications, and we believe that cluster file systems are a very viable solution. So what I mean by extremely data-intensive applications are things that are embarrassingly parallel. Things like web searching, indexing, basically anything that sort of lends itself well to partition processing. There have been frameworks out there like MapReduce and Hadoop, which are already taking advantage of this parallelism. And so that's the kind of stuff that we are looking at. So what do these applications sort of expect out of the storage underneath? Basically, now that the trend is moved towards commodity hardware for cost purposes, they expect that the storage be built out of commodity hardware and also be fault tolerant for this environment. Obviously, because of the exploding data, they expect that things scale really well. And there's something else very interesting that these new class of applications sort of brought to light. The fact that function shipping is way more efficient at this scale than doing things the other way around. So people took these requirements and went ahead and designed new file systems like GFS and HDFS to follow and KFS. And if you actually look at the requirements, won't you think that most of the cluster file systems actually do a whole bunch of these things already? And then why was the wheel reinvented? Well, there was a good reason to do so, but. So if you look at the cluster file systems and the specialized file systems one-on-one, we see that both of them sort of do really well on some things. They both scale well, they both sort of run on commodity hardware out of the box, but there are a few things that the cluster file system is not able to do currently. It doesn't support function shipping. What that means, it's not tuned to a MapReduce kind of framework. It also doesn't support the block sizes that a typical specialized file system would support. Also, it's not as fault tolerant. But then there are things that the cluster file systems have been doing really well for a long time, and that is the traditional conventional HPC kind of workloads. They've grown over years to perform so well for that workload. Also, there are very mature management tools like file sets, snapshots, backup recovery, all of that which has been around for a while. So we are trying to think of why not sort of combine the two worlds and bring out the best solution instead of, you know, being this give some, get some world. So we thought of fixing the cluster file systems for things that they're not currently able to do well and see where that goes. So to quickly take you through our journey, we first started off by naively increasing the block size for a cluster file system. We were using GPFS as a prototype file system. Well, that clearly didn't do well. Then we put in the locality information and made it sort of compatible with the function shipping aspect of things. That got us a little further ahead, but still not as well. So then we did a bunch of other tweaks, which we can discuss maybe in detail at the poster. But eventually, we sort of got at least half as good as HDFS with all of this. But if you see the other chart, it shows that on our way here, we had sort of completely lost the GPFS performance for some of the traditional applications. And that was basically because we had increased the block size widely. OK, so we still were looking for a better solution. So on our next step, we implemented a new allocation scheme in GPFS, which sort of lets all the internal GPFS functions like prefetching, caching, everything still operate at optimal GPFS block size of, say, maybe 2 MB, let all the conventional applications run at that block size, but it lets us expose a way larger block size to a MapReduce kind of framework, and that is what is that's what the function shipping applications would use. So with this optimization, you will see that we almost matched with HDFS in performance. And because we had restored our block size for GPFS back to its normal, whatever is the most optimal block size, we had also restored the performance for the conventional HPC workloads. And hence, we actually came to a place where we had the best of both worlds. So sort of having taken care of the performance part, where there's some work to be done there, but the next step is optimizing for fault tolerance, thinking of different replication schemes and stuff like that. And though it just looks like a bullet, trust me, it's a lot of work. So to sort of sum this whole thing up, I think cluster file systems are very much still in the game for these extremely data-intensive applications, and actually they might, and they are, a better solution for a world where you would want to run your normal workloads and a MapReduce kind of workload on the same data set. So I have glossed over a lot of details here, but please stop by our poster and we will answer for the questions. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Dan Pollack. This talk is about sort of data destruction and how important that is. These are just some examples of, you know, what happens when you don't sort of control and maintain your data properly. So data is import internal to the company and external to the company, and restrictions are placed on data all over the place when it's in use and also when it goes stale. And the topic is, when it goes stale, when you're done with the data or the systems that hold it, what do you do with them? Within the company, you protect the systems. Outside the company, when you're throwing stuff away, you kind of do different things. And a lot of those different things are subject to external requirements that you really have no control over as far as the company goes. There's legislation in place and all kinds of other rules, especially related to whatever the data type is. So after the useful life of the data, you do different things. Where I work, we decommission systems and give them back to the people that sold them to us, because we lease, we don't buy, and we can't afford to throw stuff away and never use it again. The parts that contain the data are things like disks, tapes, flash drives, what have you. So storage systems don't necessarily want data to go away, and that's a really difficult thing for people who build storage systems to get their heads around, right, is they spend all their time trying to protect the data and deliver the data, so now you have to figure out, well, wait, I got to get rid of it, so I got to destroy the data, and that's something that storage systems just don't do very well. Also, in addition to the inability of storage systems to destroy data efficiently, they, as they get large, more and more data needs to be destroyed, and that's sort of difficult to reconcile with high-performance data destruction when you have hundreds of terabytes or petabytes of data. So when you're talking about these large global clustered file systems with terabytes or petabytes of data, how do you destroy those all in a reasonable amount of time so that you can give them back to the people that want them to do whatever they're going to do with them next? So one of the other things you find is that storage systems are configured and optimized for the workload that they're intended to perform when they're in use, not the workload that they're intended to perform when you're trying to just destroy the data. So you look at the documentation and the standards and all those things, and they tell you there are a few ways to destroy the data, and mostly if you want to reuse the systems for other purposes, you're really left with overwrite or disposal of keys, because you can't really degauss the data. That destroys the whole system, or degauss the hardware, that destroys them, and you can't physically destroy them. Throwing them in a chipper shredder doesn't really make them very useful to anybody else. Overwrite is the most common way of destroying data these days, because disposal of keys, key shred, hasn't really been implemented yet. The standards are just becoming ratified and implemented down the road. So as part of the override challenges that you have, bandwidth through your storage systems, be they local systems with direct attached disk or storage arrays or what have you, front-end bandwidth and back-end bandwidth are always going to slow you down, and they're always going to be the absolute limit of how much data you can destroy. Also, caching tends to bottleneck. In this case, you're not writing useful data. You want to write a whole bunch of data in a hurry, so bypassing cache is actually a good thing when you're talking about data destruction. Then there's the problem of how many overwrites you have to do, and that's dependent on what the type of data is and who you're destroying it for. And then the access methods can complicate things as well. Block data overwrite is actually pretty easy. You just kind of start up a writer process and it destroys data. But when you're talking about things like NAS access or object access, what you really have to do is delete all the data that you have in place, which takes a while, and then you have to overwrite till you've filled the system again as many times as required. So there's even more overwriting and deleting. Even if you use large files, it does tend to be rather slow. So here's some obvious stuff, right? You know, things are limited by the bandwidth, right? Even high performance arrays at a gigabyte a second are only going to destroy a certain amount of data. If you have 100 terabytes, that's going to take you a long time. If you have 500 terabytes, it's going to take even longer, and eventually you're going to run out of the ability to return your arrays within a reasonable amount of time. So we usually take about a year to fill a 50 or 80 terabyte array, and we need to give it back to the people who sold it to us usually in about 2 weeks, and that's a hard thing to do if we have to write all the data over many, many times in a couple of weeks. RAID overhead has complications as well, so reconfiguring for the most high-performance RAID implementations is probably a good thing. And then device failures are really difficult to deal with, too, because you got to prove that you destroyed the data on those drives, too. And we kicked off a data scrub on about 4,800 drives this week on 440 hosts, and we've already seen a 5x increase in the number of drives that are failed during that versus normal during that same period. Here's just a list of the override optimizations. I'm out of time, so I'll just say a quick thing about validation, which is sample data is really helpful for validation, and also there's some really good ways to destroy data that exist in the world, but they're not as widely implemented as they need to be, so asking folks who build storage systems to include ways to implement secure erase, which is a data destruction command built into every drive that's pretty much built after the year 2000, and some of these other things like Keyshred are really, really helpful. Thanks.
Good afternoon. My name is Lei Tian. I will present our work in progress report. What should I do? Good afternoon. My name is Lei Tian. I will present our working progress report. The question we want to address is as follows. In an exabyte level or large storage system that stores billions of files, how to find the files I want efficiently? There are two kinds of complex query examples. The first one is a range query. Which experiment did I run yesterday that took less than 30 minutes and generated the file larger than 2 gigabytes? The second example is the top K query. I cannot accurately remember a previously created file, but I know that its file size is around 300 megabytes, and it was last visited around January 1st, 2008. Can the system show 10 files that are closest to this description? The current approach has some problems. For example, directory tree-based management, metadata management has the problem of prohibitively high overhead due to exhaustive or brute force searches. The problem of a database technique is not very efficient due to ignoring access locality and the screw distribution of file metadata. So we propose a novel decentralized semantic aware metadata organization scheme called a smart store to enable efficient complex queries. The big idea behind the smart store is to group and store files according to their metadata semantic correlation so that query and other relevant operation can be completely within one or small number of such groups. In our current design, latent semantic indexing tool is used to measure the semantic correlation of file metadata. Secondly, we organize file metadata into a semantic R tree based on the above semantic correlation analysis, in which semantic R tree is a multi-dimensional structure to organize file metadata and represent their multi-dimensional attributes according to the semantic correlations. This figure compares our smart store with conventional file system. Our smart store consists of index units and storage units based on mapping and grouping operations to serve complex queries. Currently, we have implemented a prototype of a smart store that interactively aggregates files into groups until a single group is obtained. The picture compares the query latency of a smart store with the R3 approach without considering the semantical grouping and the mapping and the conventional database management system. From the picture, from the figure, one can see that our smart store can improve the performance significantly. Thank you.
Hello, so my name's Mike Manier, and today I'm going to talk about a project that's relatively new. It's collaborative with LSI, and it's called Differentiated Storage Services. For the networking folks, it's a lot like DiffServe, where we want to put a little bit of information in each I.O. so that storage systems can actually differentiate. So the motivation here is really one of SSD integration, but it goes far beyond that. But specifically for SSDs, what we want to do is find a good way of taking an SSD and plugging it into a disk array. Okay, now there are some obvious ways of doing this. For example, we could just use the SSD as a big read-write cache, right? But we know that these things might potentially wear out over time, so we want to be careful about how much data we actually put into it. A second option at the file system level is to use it as a whole file cache and actively migrate important files into the SSD, right? And another option is to just simply punt and let the file system worry about block allocation and expose the entire storage topology to the FS. But we don't think that any of these solutions is really that suitable for the enterprise where you have really large, complex storage systems. Now, the storage systems themselves can actually help us out quite a bit if we just let them, right? Specifically, we know that file systems have a variety of I/O classes. Metadata versus data is one distinction. These different classes probably want different QoS, and today they're not getting it without a lot of work. Now, the storage systems can provide differentiated services if they just knew what the class of each I/O was. Okay, the missing ingredient here is really I/O classification. At the block layer, it's really difficult to tell what's in an I/O, whether it's important or not, and that's what we want to try and fix. So differentiated storage services, think of it as really a QoS framework for file and storage systems. On the host side, the file system's responsible for identifying its various I/O classes. And I've got a few listed here, and this is just these are just examples. Metadata versus the journal. Directories or regular file blocks, or maybe the type of file that a block lives in. Is it an executable or is it a backup? All of this class information can be made known to the storage system in an opaque way, and they could actually optimize around that. Once the classes are defined, the file system will assign a QoS policy to each class. For example, metadata could be given the highest priority. Now, over on the storage system side, if you have a way of specifying the class of each I/O, and you know the QoS policy associated with it, then you can differentiate within the storage system. In this example here, I'm showing that we have a disk pool and an SSD pool. We might want to reserve the SSD for the high priority classes, but it's up to the file system to tell us which classes are of high priority. Now, to get the information from the file system to the storage system, we want to do this in band. And it turns out there are actually reserved bytes in the SCSI CDB, possibly an ATA, where you can specify a class identifier for each I/O. Right now we're using 5 bits, so it gives us 32 different classes, and it's actually more than enough for now. So as you can imagine, there's a ton of research here. How you classify I/O is a big deal, and for the database, it's going to be totally different, and it's even going to vary across file systems. The QoS policies that you associate with each class, there will need to be some agreement between the file system and the storage system as to what policies are even available, and then the file system will have to choose from those. And then separately, the QoS mechanisms are going to be completely opaque to the file system because we've totally separated policy from mechanism here. And the storage system is free to implement QoS in whatever way that it wants, and we think that's actually good. Now, we've prototyped this in Linux using ext3. We defined 8 different I/O classes. You can see here, there's the metadata, the journal, and directory blocks. This is all the management stuff. Immediate blocks we treat special. That's the first 4K of each file. And then the other classes kind of represent the offset within a file, where everything greater than 256K, we just consider bulk data. The cutoff points are somewhat arbitrary there, but for our prototype, it actually worked out okay. By the way, this was a weekend exercise classifying EXT3. You had to go in and look at the code and just put this in. Someone developing a file system could actually do a much better job. Now, on the storage system side, we had three different priority levels, high, middle, and low. So we just made the metadata, the journal, and the directory highest priority. Middle priority is the regular file data within the first 256K, and low priority is everything beyond that. As far as a storage system mechanism, we're using a new technique called selective caching. We've got the SSD as a read-write cache, but we make sure that only high and middle priority blocks go into the cache, so it actually we won't burn that cache out over time. And now we use the SCSI CDB, those 5 bits, to just embed the class information, which means that everything's passed in band, not out of band, which is much more efficient. As far as a summary, this, again, is really a QoS framework. We've prototyped it for EXT3, but we expect to do similar things with NTFS and some of the newer file systems coming out. It totally separates policy from mechanism, which we think is a really good thing. And it enables a lot of new optimization within the storage system, which is kind of exciting. And we've got a poster. I'd love to hear from you. Thanks.
My name is Xiaojiu Li. I'm from HP Labs. This is joint work with my colleagues at HP Labs and UT Austin. I'm going to talk about consistability. Oops. So let's begin with a very simple observation. The observation is that, look at this diagram. The x-axis is the number of failures in a system, and the y-axis is the consistency provided by this system. The observation is the following. Some systems, for example, databases, they tend to provide better consistency when the number of failures are small. However, they sort of degrade relatively noticeably when the number of failures increase. On the other hand, there are also this kind of, this different kind of systems that they remain relatively stable, although the consistency provided is not very high to begin with. Now, here's the question. How do we compare these two kinds of systems? On one end, one is better than the other. On the other end, it's the other way around. So looking at either ends probably is a narrow view. Now, how do we describe systems in terms of the consistency provided more comprehensively? And perhaps more importantly, for an end user, how do we compare systems more comprehensively? And that motivates the notion of consistability. In a few words, consistability is just the analogous idea as performability, if you have heard of that word before. The same idea, but applied to consistency. Again, an example would help very much. And again, it's a similar diagram. We have x-axis as the number of failures, but more concrete, from no failures to network partitioning. And on the y-axis, we have different kinds of consistencies, ranging from atomic to infinity regular. I am slightly lying right here, but I won't go into the detail yet, but I will come back to that later. So in this diagram, I've plotted the behavior of two systems, A and B. You can sort of see that the red triangles is the behavior of system A, and the blue squares are the behavior of system B. They sort of intertwine, as you can see. And perhaps more importantly, besides being an abstract notion, consistency actually allows us to describe the frequency of certain consistency being achieved by both systems. Here's a simple calculation. For example, if we want to know how often system A achieves atomicity from this diagram, given that system A has no failures with probability 70%, then we can sort of calculate that the probability of achieving atomic consistency would be 70% of the time. And similarly, we can calculate other kinds of consistencies for B, say 5 regularity is achieved for system B in no failures, 1 to 2 failures, and 3 to 4 failures, and that's how you add that up. So you can calculate all this kind of different consistencies for both systems, and then With that relatively complete description of both systems, then an end user could sort of decide which one is better. For example, if the end system cares more about atomic consistency, then perhaps system B is better, a better choice. But if the system, the end user says, I absolutely require 5 regularity all the time, then perhaps system A is to be preferred. Now, I just said that I slightly lied in the previous slides, but what do I mean by that? That comes from the sort of a tricky issue of consistencies. I implied by drawing consistency on an axis that consistency can be totally ordered, but that is exactly that is not the case. There are many consistencies that have been proposed before, and they actually form a partially ordered set, poset, and we can draw them in a lattice, but they cannot be totally ordered. And besides that, there are other open questions. And since I'm out of time, visit our poster if you have time. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Nitin Agarwal from the University of Wisconsin. And today I'll talk about how to do speedy and scalable file system benchmarking, the system that we're developing called compressions. So here's an example of what the kind of problem we're trying to solve is how to run a terabyte-sized workload if you only have a 100 gigabyte disk. And hopefully in the process, do it a little faster too. So if this was not convincing enough, why would we need that? There's several trends which further motivate the need for a solution to the problem. First is we are seeing increasing disk capacities, and with that, we are seeing an increasing amount of user data that is being stored on these in these large disk. We're seeing terabyte-sized disk frequently available for desktop machines and enterprise moving to petabyte scale. Also, it turns out that a lot of applications that we care about, first of all, we're seeing an increasing repertoire of applications and longer running applications. And a lot of the applications we care about, like integrity checks like FSCK or building a search index or doing a virus scan on these large partitions can take anywhere from several hours to a few days. And finally, with the emergence of newer storage technologies like SSDs, which offer higher performance but have lower capacity because of higher pricing, one question then would be to how to run an application and benchmark it, which has a larger working set than available for a smaller capacity SSD. So here's how a typical file system stack looks like for benchmarking. You have a benchmark workload running on top of a file system, running on top of a larger disk, right? So there are two problems with this setup, right? First is the amount of disk storage required for some of the large workloads that I'm talking about. And second is also the time spent doing disk I/O. So our solution to this problem is to introduce a system called compressions, which sits beneath the file system on top of the disk. And the key idea is really to run the workload on a compressed version of the disk. So what compressions do is first, to solve the problem of requiring large amount of disk storage, is it remaps only the metadata blocks efficiently on disk. So now you need a much smaller disk partition. And secondly, it avoids going to the disk for any I/O to data blocks. And I'll show in the next slide what I mean by that. Since now we're messing around with the layout of files on disk and not issuing certain I/O, the time as measured by the application is no longer accurate. So now we need some kind of model at the disk level which gives accurate results for benchmarking. Okay, so here's how compressions works. You have, say, an original disk image with metadata blocks in red and data blocks in blue, and you'd issue reads and writes to these blocks. So you pretty much need the entire disk to run your workload, right? So now we introduce compressions. And the first thing it does is it remaps all I/O to metadata blocks to a much smaller compressed version of the new partition. And secondly, it any write that it sees to a file data block, it just throws away. It just squashes any writes to non-metadata blocks. Any subsequent read to a data block is now generated synthetically on the fly using a content generator. So you might imagine what kind of applications would work under this situation. So FSCK is a great example and something that is a good motivating example where the application doesn't really care about the actual data that sits inside the file system blocks, the data blocks, but really wants to traverse the entire file system namespace. And also applications like desktop search, which do care about what file content is inside the data blocks, the content generator has statistical models which do a pretty good approximation of the kind of file content you want to have in different types of natural language or multimedia files. So given this modified setup, we have significantly reduced the amount of storage that we need to run this run this benchmark workload. As I said, since we are completely changing the disk layout for both metadata blocks and not issuing any I/O for the data blocks, the time as measured by the application is no longer accurate. And since we want to do accurate benchmarking, the disk model sitting inside the kernel intercepts any I/O activity and maintains the accurate timing that would have taken place had the workload run on the original setup. Just to kind of show you a quick evaluation, is we ran a simple PostMark configuration on our compressed setup, and we found that even for small workloads, we see a tenfold reduction in the amount of disk storage that requires. Looking at the relative speed up in time with remapping and squashing, we see that preliminary results show great promise, and the results are bound to improve for larger setups because it basically boils down to the ratio of metadata and data in a file system, and as we move towards larger setups, the ratio becomes even more favorable. So as I'm running out of time, I'd be happy to have questions outside. I don't have a poster, but feel free to find me outside, and I'd love to talk more about it. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Pingo, and I will present my ongoing work named Out of Place Journal. Okay, one important problem in file system design is that it must ensure the data integrity in face of system crash. Generally, there are three major techniques used to solve the problem. The first one is that the file system try to keep the sequence of dependent writes, such as this technique, including synchronized writes and soft updates and something like that. And the second technique used to solve problem is using non-volatile memory. And the third technique, we call it atomic write. This technique can guarantee that the system transfer from one consistent state to another consistent one. Generally, there are two techniques, there are two mechanisms can be implemented to achieve this technique. They are logging and copy and write model. According to our analysis, in both mechanicals, atomic writes consists of two procedures. The first one is named state saving. During this phase, the system will save the new states of changed data on the stable storage. The overhead of this phase is hard to avoid because if you don't save the new data on another place on a disk and update that in the home location in the file system directly, obviously you can't recover the file system to a consistent state if the system crash during your updating. And the other property of this phase is that the overhead of this procedure is nearly the same for logging and copy and write because the file system will write new data sequentially on disk for both mechanisms. And after the new state reaches the storage media, logging and copy and write will perform updating procedure. In this procedure, logging employs in-place updates while copy and write adopts out-of-place updates. Okay, let's look at what happens on disk by some figures. With logging, in this figure we have three blocks. One block have two pointers, point to block one and block B. In logging mechanism, if we want to update block A, block one and block two atomically, At first, we will write block 1 and block 2 in a log. After that, we will update block 1 and block 2. In copy and write model, we will write block 1 and block 2 at another place on disk. After that, the pointer in block P will change, and the new pointer will point to the saved state. As a result, the block B will be changed correspondingly. So the idea is that after the first phase of atomic write, new data have already reached the disk. So how about we just use the new state directly? We don't need to if we can do that, we don't need to update block 1 and block 2 in file system or change the pointers in block P. This will reduce lots of write overhead. So we implement a simple prototype to evaluate our idea. Mapping layer and journal is inserted into file system to into the file system. The mapping layer is consists of a mapping table and two modules. The mapping table contains contain mapping entries which can map the logical block address, map one logical block address to physical block address on the disk. Actually, the physical block address in our system is the log record number. And the address transfer module is to use the table to do the address transfer between logical block number and the physical block number. The table management module is to is used to insert table entries or delete table entries, create table entries, or something like that. The journal consists of three different kinds of log records. It's nearly the same as EFT3 file system. The first kind of log record is description record. It will describe the home location of log record in the file system, and the date record just hold the new date of blocks, and the commit record will show that one transaction is committed. The tricky part is that by using the content in the description record, we can reconstruct the mapping table, because all the information we need is in this kind of records. So, okay, there are four phases in our algorithm. The first we call normal processing. This phase is to handling read and write. The checkpoint is to checkpoint the mapping table. This can reduce the recovery time of our mapping layer. And the garbage collection will collect the data fragment in the data journal. Crash recovery is used to recover the mapping table. This procedure can divide into two parts. The first part is to retrieve the latest checkpoint of mapping table, and the second is to analyze all description records after the checkpoint to reconstruct the latest mapping table. And we do some experiment in, okay. So this is the experiment. You can see that we can provide comparable. Oh, okay, it's over. So if you have any questions, we can talk about it in the post section.
You need it.